welcome to episode 29. Yes, episode 29. One episode away from the season finale of Victims of Fun. This is El Stevo, your host. As always, we are live from Mr. Fujiwara's Top Ramen Shop in the Chiba District of Tokyo, right across from the Sailor Moon store. Big shout out to Anchor, best podcast hosting and software on the planet. Big shout out to Blue Microphones. I have the Blue Snowball Yeti. Another shout out to Seagate. The external SSD drive stores the entire podcast. And a big, big shout out to Apple. My Apple MacBook M1 Air creates the podcast. Without any of these items, the Victims of Fun would not be on the air. So hello, everybody. I hope everything is going good. I haven't done a podcast for a couple days because I've just been busy doing other things. And I got some news for you. We're going to be relocating the show back to Florida. The years we've been doing it here in Tokyo are coming to an end. It has nothing to do with being happy here at Mr. Fujiwara's or anything. It's been quite good. I just have some financial incentives and financial things I'd like to take care of, and it's easier if I'm back in the States. So, after all this time, we will be relocating Victims of Fun back to Florida. We're going to find a new spot to podcast in, because, you know, I don't like podcasting from the studio in my house or whatever back there. I kind of like being, you know, live somewhere, and, you know, it's kind of a good thing. And I'd like to continue that tradition. Mr. Fujiwara is already upset, but there will be another podcast we'll be moving into Mr. Fujiwara's Top Ramen Shop. It will be a Japanese language podcast. I don't know the name of it, but I know he's already got it lined up, and I will be passing the table, because I always do the podcast from this one table here in the ramen shop. I will be passing the table on to the new podcaster, and we'll actually have him in here next episode. This should be our season finale, because then we gotta relocate back to Florida in the United States. And there you go. So we'll be back in America. I need to be looking after some financial stuff I got going on there. Mostly my cryptocurrencies and everything else I'm invested in. And it's easier to do it over there than it is here. I love being here. I'd like to come back. You know, but I'll follow the money, basically. So back I go. And there you go. I'm going back to the United States, back to Florida. Be podcasting from there. You know, I was never a big fan of Florida. I remember being a little kid, we'd always come to Florida for vacation. And we kept coming to Florida. Every year we'd go to Disney, and after a while I was like, you know, every year we go to Disney, I want to go to the Grand Canyon or somewhere else. And my father's like, nope, we're going to Disney. And I said, that's because everybody else goes to Disney and they get a discount and it's cheap. Whatever. But, you know, I mean, nothing against the people in Florida. It's just I got tired of it, you know. And when you've lived overseas, when you lived for all the time I lived in Europe, I mean, the one building I lived in was almost as old as the United States of America itself. And you're living in, like, Japan, or even if you live in Russia or Southeast Asia or whatever, you know, America's your home country, but it's kind of difficult to come back when you're exposed to other things. There's things you appreciate by coming back to the United States, and then there's things you miss from where you were living before. And, you know, maybe if I was moving back to, like, New York City or Redondo Beach. Well, I don't know if I'd live in California now, but, you know, back to Hoboken or something, it'd be, you know, better. But Florida, you know, it's basically flat, and it's full of, like, malls and like strip malls, and there's millions of old people here and they don't know how to drive, and there's love bugs, and ugh, boy, it's just, yeah, I'm so sick of Disney. I was never a big Disney fan, and it had nothing to do with their politics. It's just, I got tired of it. It's stupid mouse, you know, who cares? And I got mad, they took the best ride out of Disney years ago, the best ride they ever had at Disney. And the one thing that made Disney bearable when we would go all the time was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was the bomb biggity. I remember the first time I went to Disney, it was me and my mom and dad, my uncle Jack and Aunt Rosie. Aunt Rosie was my mom's sister. My cousins Kenny and Sherry. And Sherry lives in New Jersey. And she's got a very, very... She's got two kids, Kevin, who's just... Kevin Peter, his middle name's after my father. Kevin's really funny. Jacqueline, her daughter, is one of the most talented individuals you ever meet. This girl can sing, she can dance, she gets on Broadway, or she gets breaks into Hollywood, she's going to be big. She's absolutely just... She's got that old-school talent that you really don't see anymore. And I'm talking, like, real talent. Real Broadway talent. You know, growing up, I was always the theater kid in my family. I'm the one that did theater. I'm the one that sang. I'm the one that danced. I did all that. And there was nobody else. And Jacqueline kind of fills that role now, which is fantastic. She's very, very talented. She's a good kid. She's a fantastic person. Was raised right. And Kevin's a big video game guy. And he's cool. I like him. But anyway, So, anyway, me, Kenny, Sherry, Mom, Dad, Uncle Jack, Aunt Rosie, come to Disney first time, and go on all the rides, and, you know, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride back then. And back then, Disney had the tickets. You know, you get an E-ticket, an A-ticket, and you traded in those tickets for certain rides at Disney. And, so, you know, you had your A ticket, your B ticket, and whatnot. And, you know, the big thing was Space Mountain. Like, oh my God, Space Mountain's so dangerous. And back then you heard this rumor that some kid got decapitated on it. And, you know, so obviously, you know, we were too young to go on Space Mountain. And, they had Eastern Airlines, if you had wings, which was great, and you had the Carousel of Tomorrow, which, you know, you look back on it, and, like, all that stuff, half that stuff didn't come true. Like, we don't have flying cars, so, hey, Elon Musk, you want to jump on that. And we're not living on the moon, which I wanted to live on the moon. I remember being a little kid and reading in Popular Mechanics or Disney or something, by 20, you know, something or other, you know, about a year 2000, we'll be living on the moon, and you could travel back and forth to the moon like you're going to another state. Well, you know what? I'm not living on the moon. I was so looking forward to living on the freaking moon, and we're not. And I'm very angry, and if I could sue somebody over this, I would. And we were supposed to have flying cars. You know, there's no flying cars. You know. But you think about it, that's probably a bad idea. Because especially in Florida, all these old goats driving around. They can't drive on the ground, let alone flying through the air. Oh, look out, Sonny. Boom. You know, whatever. So anyway. Welcome to Disney first time. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. If You Had Wings. Carousel Tomorrow. The Formula One race car thing, which was great, and, the Haunted Mansion, which freaked me out, that was fun, and The best ride, though, was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And for anybody who's old enough that's been to Disney that was on it, you gotta admit, that was the absolute best ride Disney ever made. And for you, those of you who never got to be on it, that are younger, you don't know what you're missing. So basically, you get on a replica of the Nautilus from the movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which is a classic. Kirk Douglas, Peter Lorre, James Mason. The movie is so good that they never remade it, because you can't top it. It's like Jaws. You can't remake it. The design of the Nautilus is just incredible. And so you get on this replica of the Nautilus, and you go down the stairs, and you're actually, you know, part of the submarine's on the surface, but when you get on it, because of the way it's constructed, when you go down the stairs, you're actually descending, and you're in the lower part of the sub, which is, you know, underneath the surface of the water. And that serves a purpose, because as the ride starts... Now, this submarine's on a track, so it just goes straight. But using the illusions of water movement and bubbles coming out from the side of the submarine, you feel like you're actually descending into the deep. So you're there, and you're like, oh, okay, now we're going to zoom down to 20,000 leagues under the sea. And you're sitting there, and the submarine kind of shakes a little bit, and all these bubbles start shooting out outside the portholes, and the bubbles are going straight up on an angle. And it tricks your brain into thinking you're actually descending, when actually you're literally 3 feet underwater. You know, as a little kid, though, you're like, holy shit, we're going 20,000 leagues under the sea. This is fantastic. And of course, you know, you're a little kid, you don't think of the fact that you're in a pool in an enclosed area in the middle of Florida. You're not in the middle of the ocean, but, you know, you're a kid. What do you know? You still believe in Santa Claus at that point. So, you get down there and you see all these weird plastic fish, angler fish and, you know, angel fish, and all these weird fishies. And it's like, oh, look, here is the lost city of Atlantis. And you see mermaids, and the mermaids are waving at you, and unfortunately they have clamshells where their boobs are. You know, it would have been nice if they didn't, but you're a little kid, what do you know? And, you know, treasure chests of gold and statues, and, you know, there's the ruins of Atlantis. And then the sub shakes a bit, and the red light comes on, and he's like, oh, we just got a distress call. One of the other Nautiluses is under attack. And you look out the porthole, and they're like, look to the left, and then look to the right, because either side of the sub, and you see in the distance a Nautilus in the grips of a very cheesy-looking giant squid. Now, you're a little kid, you don't know any better. You know, I'm sure my father and my uncle were laughing their heads off, but you're a little kid, you're like, ah, my God, it's a freaking giant squid, ah! And then suddenly, the guy's like, oh no, there's a giant squid right in front of us. And the submarine goes through, and there's squid tentacles, like, grabbing the sub. And the sub actually stops. The ride stops, or something. And, no, it doesn't stop, because, it does it stop? Yeah, I think it did stop, because the subs are spaced out. It's literally only stopped for like 20 seconds. And you're in the middle of these giant squid tentacles that are around the sub, and it's like, oh, we're being attacked by a giant squid, we're gonna be crushed. And I'm like, oh crap, what the hell, ah. And he's like, oh, we'll have to electrify the hull of the Nautilus to drive the squid off. And the lights flicker, and there's a strobe light thing, and you hear bzzz, you know, your typical stereotypical electric thing. And suddenly you start moving again, and the squid tentacles are gone. He's like, oh, we need to get out of here and report back into headquarters. Sorry, we're going to have to cut the tour short. And then you pull back into where you came off of. It's like, well, we apologize for that giant squid attack, but we hope you enjoyed your trip. It's like, yeah, you almost killed us and just traumatized an entire submarine full of, like, you know, elementary school kids. But yeah, we enjoyed the trip. Get my lawyer. But it was the greatest ride because you actually believed you were on this sub being attacked by a giant squid, even though you're in the middle of Florida, nowhere near the ocean. And the only squid in the middle of Florida are at the restaurants, or, you know, calamari or something. And then, you know, years later, Disney, you know, the Disney family passes away, and Disney's bought by different corporations, and now it's just this, it's this giant octopus that has its tentacles and everything, and it's got no soul. And they took all the old rides out. The old Formula One track is gone. The old Eastern Airlines, if you had wings thing, is gone. The Carousel Tomorrow is gone. And then the day came and they took 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea out. And people, that was the one ride everybody got angry over that they took out. Everybody was like, all right, Eastern Airlines went out of business, fine. The Formula One track really wasn't that good anyway because the cars only did 5 miles an hour and they were on a track and you never controlled them, whatever. Carousel Tomorrow, fine, we understand that because all the technology and it's outdated and it's talking about things that we've had for the past 20 years. Get rid of it. But 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was where people drew the line. They're like, no, you cannot take 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea out of Disney. It is part of people's collective consciousness and culture and experience. But Disney's run by accountants, and all they see is money, and they took it out. And I don't know what they put in there. Probably something to do with Frozen or some other bullshit. Because I guarantee you, in 50 years, nobody's going to remember Frozen or any of the other modern Disney properties. But I guarantee you, they're still going to remember 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And, I mean, the Haunted Mansion, as far as I know, is still there. Pirates of the Caribbean, obviously, is still there because of the whole Jack Sparrow thing. But I think they actually put Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean. And they changed a lot of it because, you know, in today's climate and culture, the parts of the ride where they were chasing the women and everything, that's gone because that's misogyny. So you can't have that. What I think is hysterical is they had to close Pirates of the Caribbean for a while and redo the boats because people were getting so much fatter that they were bottoming out the boats and damaging them. And Disney had to go in and, like, I don't know if they made the boats more buoyant or lowered the tracks, but they had to compensate for the fact that, like, a lot of the guests were really, really, really big. But old Disney, and now it's like $5,000 to go to Disney. You actually, when you're born, you have to set up like a savings account to be able to afford to go to Disney. And, but the old Disney was something else. And that was our first trip to Disney as kids and everything. I remember it rained and, we stayed at the Hyatt House and then we stayed at some little hotel and I think my Uncle Jack caught a barracuda. Or something. But we drove down. And the first time we drove down, we all piled in my uncle's Cadillac. And the second time we drove down, my parents and I had our own car. We had a 74 Oldsmobile. And we had CB radios. And my father and my uncle would always check in going, we need gas yet? Because, you know, my uncle in his Cadillac and my dad in his, you know, Oldsmobile, they were getting like 10 miles of the gallon each, so we were stopping at gas stations every hour and a half. But gas back then was 50 cents a gallon, so nobody cared. And we always stayed at south of the border. And if you've ever been on the, if you've ever been to the east coast of the United States, and you go up from Florida to the north, or from the north down, you'll see signs that say, 180 miles to Pedro, south of the border. And south of the border is like a little, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like an old school tourist trap type of hotel and setup. They have this big, stereotypical Mexican guy named Pedro with the mustache and the sombrero. That's their symbol. And they still have it because they won't cave in to anybody who complains. And the tradition was you always stopped at south of the border because that was kind of like if you were coming from New Jersey or New York, south of the border, that part of Carolina was like, all right, I can't drive any further because it's nighttime or my legs are about to explode. And everybody stopped at south of the border. And you had your little hotel rooms, and they had their own amusement park and their own restaurants, and they had their own gift shop thing. And, you know, they had tourist trap type gifts, and, you know, some of it was really cool. They would have Mexican jumping beans, you know. And, of course, Mexican jumping beans are actually like cockroach eggs or something. And, you know, they would have, like, oh, fossilized dinosaur teeth, and they were just rocks, and, you know, real kishy, touristy stuff. But, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was fun. And south of the border is still there. And I remember after my dad passed away and my mother moved to Florida, I drove the moving van. And, you know, we loaded it up and everything, and I drove the moving van. I'd never driven a moving van before, and the first time I'm doing it, I have all my mother's furniture in the back of this thing. Because, you know, she sold the family house, dad died, and she's coming to Florida because everybody else was here. And I was moving to Europe, so. So I have all her expensive dining room center. I'm driving this thing, and I had never driven anything that big before in my life. And my uncle, Tony, actually set up the bus driver training program at Disney, and he gave me like a 1 hour crash course on how to drive something like this. And I'm like, I couldn't even park the thing, and he's shaking his head, and finally he's like, hey, you know what, because that's the way he talked, like Dusty Rhodes basically. But my Uncle Tony and my mother and my late Aunt Brenda and my Aunt Marie, Auntie we call her, they came down in my mother's car. So the moving van, me, leaves at 5 in the morning from New Jersey. And they finish the house closing about 9. And they then drive my mother's car down. So they're like 4 hours behind me. By the way, they actually passed me somewhere in Georgia. That's how much of a maniac driver my Uncle Tony was. Rest in peace. But I remember he gave me the crash course in driving the moving van, and I'm, like, doing bad, and he just shakes his head and goes, well, if we're driving down the road and we see a moving van with a bunch of furniture, I know you couldn't handle it. So I'm like, yeah, thanks, you know? And I remember my mother saying, yeah, we always were looking for furniture on the side of the road, figuring you flipped the damn thing. But one of the things I said was, I'll drive the moving van, I don't care, but I'm stopping at south of the border. And I stopped at south of the border because you know, it's kitschy. I loved it. And the other tradition, if you ever drove from the north to Florida, was you always saw a sign for Stuckey's. And Stuckey's was like a roadside gift shop sandwich place thing. I think you used to be able to gas up there, but Stuckey's was, and, you know, they sold fireworks because to buy fireworks is illegal in New Jersey, but you can buy it everywhere else because New Jersey is run by fascists. So, yeah, everybody always stopped at Stuckey's, and that was the other thing, you know, and you always saw a sign, oh, here's Stuckey's, but the next one's in 160 miles. And once you started seeing the signs for Pedro, all the kids would get, like, really excited, like, oh my God, 400 miles to Pedro, 400 miles to Pedro. And it was just, it was like a rite of passage. You know, and, you know, south of the border is still there. And, I said that, if I ever, you know, got back to Florida and had to go to New Jersey, I was stopping at south of the border both ways. You know, there and back. Because that was the old days, you know. Now, I guess you just, everybody flies or you just drive. If you have a Tesla, it just drives for you. You know. But you know, I kind of miss those days. You know, you had no GPS, you had no cell phones, you know, you talked to each other on a CB, and you had an Exxon map. And if you couldn't figure out where you're going, you're kind of screwed. You know, it's like, oh well, I don't know where we are. But, alright, so we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back with some more stuff to talk about. And remember, you can email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Just do searches for Victims of Fun. You'll see our new logo. It's quite nice. And you can become a supporter and click on the supporter thing. And oh, by the way, we are apparently now available on... are we available on Pandora? I believe we are. I want to make sure, because I got the email notification before. Let's see here. We are now available on Pandora, yes. So now you can go on Pandora and look for Victims of Fun, and we're on Pandora. So there you go. Still waiting for the iHeartRadio approval. But now if you have Pandora, you can listen to us there. You can still be a supporter. Send me money, because I need it. All right, be back in a bit. And we're back with part two. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Victims of Fun. You just do a search, and it will pop up, and you'll see our new logo. Our new logo has the Blue Yeti Snowball microphone in it. It says Victims of Fun with the yellow text. You can also email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. Send me your praise, send me your hate, send me your criticism. You can also click the support button on Spotify and whatever you listen to us on, and you can send us money, because I need money. I mean, seriously, you people need to start sending me money, because, like, I have bills I have to pay, and I want to buy a villa in Monaco or Greece, and I kind of need, like, a lot of money, so... You need to start sending me yours, because you're not really doing anything with it. So you might as well give it to me. You know? Seriously. So send it my way. And remember, we are now on Pandora. So you can just go on Pandora and find me there as well. I was thinking about getting some Victims of Fun merchandise made up. You know, business cards, buttons, stickers. But all that costs money. So you need to start sending me money so I can have that stuff made up so I can make more money. That's the name of the game. Right then and there. You know? Send me your money. I don't know what kind of merchandise I would make. I mean the business cards, the buttons, stickers. Stuff I could leave around places that people go, oh, Victims of Fun, that's a podcast? So, you know, there's a lot of specialized podcasts out there. A lot of them are, like, specifically for one genre or one topic. And that's all well and good. You know, anybody who puts that much work and time into it gets respect. But I'm trying not to pigeonhole myself into talking about one thing all the time. I mean, My friend the other day, she's like, well, you're really into, like, Godzilla movies. I'm like, yeah, I grew up on them. You know, my father used to sit and watch them with me. She's like, well, there's, like, 30, 35 Godzilla movies. Why don't you take one movie an episode and just talk about the movie the entire episode? And then that would give you, like, 30 episodes. I'm like, because then I'd be pigeonholing myself into being, like, the guy who talks about Godzilla. I'm like, and yeah... I would have an audience, but I wouldn't have a massively big audience. I would have a devoted small audience, which is fine, but, you know, the really big podcasts don't really pigeonhole themselves into stuff like that. And unless they've been doing this for so long, and unless they've got some angle that they can play up, like maybe they were an actor, or they have friends in the industry that they can get on their podcast. And, you know, there's this one podcast, I forget what it's called, but it's all about horror films. And every week this girl talks about horror films and the horror genre. And I'm like, okay, that's fine, but that's not something I would listen to every single episode because eventually I'd get tired of it. And it's the same thing like talking about Godzilla every podcast. And eventually people are going to get tired of hearing about it. And eventually I would get tired of talking about it. I give the example that I love pizza. Okay, pepperoni pizza, cheesesteaks, shrimp cocktail. Oh my god, just the best stuff in the world. I couldn't eat it every day. Because eventually I'd get tired of it. As much as I would love a traditional Philly cheesesteak, which as I've gone over many times, is just the roll, steakums, and cheese whiz. As much as I love that, if I had to eat it every day, eventually I'm going to get tired of it. Maybe not the first week, eventually I would. And you can't do that. And I don't even know if I could stay on one. I have enough problems trying not to be scatterbrained with this thing. Because my stuff I talk about goes in so many different directions. Sometimes I wonder if people can actually follow it. But to me, that's more interesting than saying, okay, this episode, we're going to talk about the original Godzilla. Next episode is Godzilla Raids Again. Next episode is Godzilla, you know, versus King Kong, and just, we keep going. What am I supposed to do? You know, I'll talk about it once in a while, but I'm not going to talk about it every day. It's like, I think the only podcast you can get away with that with is sports, because sports isn't static. Like, if you're talking about football, there's something going on every week. If you're talking about basketball or baseball or hockey or even MMA or UFC or pro wrestling, there's something happening every week. So you can talk about it every week, but it's always different. You know, talking about a specific genre of a film, it's always going to be the same. Nothing's going to change. And I don't know enough about enough sports to talk about it. The only thing I could probably pull off would be pro wrestling, but there's no way you're going to compete with somebody like Stone Cold Steve Austin or Jim Cornette or any of the other guys that have been in the business for years that know things and can get people on. There's no way to compete against that. So there's no point in doing that. So my thing is, I'm just going to just turn the mic on and go. Because, you know, you never know what's going to come out of my mouth. Like I try to explain this to somebody, is I don't work off a script. I don't even work off an outline. I just, when I'm ready to do the podcast, I sit down, I have something to drink, and I turn everything on, and I go. And whatever comes out of my mouth, comes out of my mouth. And if it's good, great. If it's bad, oh well. I don't do redos. Okay? I don't. The only time I would do a redo of a podcast is if something happened during it that ruined the audio. That's the only time I do a do-over. I do one take, and I go. That's it. One take, Steve. Johnny Carson was the same way. Johnny Carson did one take. And if he messed it up, then too bad. Fix it in editing, or just leave it the way it was. And he would do one take, and he's done. You know, that's just... And I remember the movie King of Comedy is Scorsese. It was Robert De Niro, and he kidnaps a talk show host, and it was Jerry Lewis. Where originally, Scorsese wanted Johnny Carson. He wrote the part for Johnny Carson, and went to Johnny Carson and begged him to be in the film. And Carson told Scorsese, you know, I only do one take. And I know when you do films, you can't really do one take. He said, so... Unless you can guarantee that basically one take is all it's going to be, that's it. And you know, obviously, you know, Carson didn't want to do it because he only does one take. He's not going to keep doing the same scene over and over again to get it right. I mean, can you imagine him working with Stanley Kubrick? I mean, have you ever seen that movie, The Shining? Okay. The adaptation of the Stephen King movie with Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall and Scatman Crothers. brilliant, brilliant actor and singer. Scatman Crothers deserves more respect and credit these days than he gets, because he's fantastic. A lot of people just know him from The Shining, or as the voice on, like, of Hong Kong Fooey, or the voice of Jazz from The Transformers, or Scooby-Doo. But Scatman Crothers was a fantastic performer. His scat style of singing and dance, and it's just his overall performance. He deserves a lot more credit than I think he's given outside of, like, the people that, like, follow that type of thing. He deserves more mainstream credit than he ever got. But anyway, so Kubrick drove Scatman Crothers to tears, because Kubrick did one scene with Scatman Crothers, I forget which scene it was, where he made him do the scene 140 times. And I think it was the scene where Scatman Crothers is looking at the... I think it was right after he got axed or got killed, like he was being killed or stabbed. He has this look of horror on his face. And that was the shot that Kubrick made him do like 100 and something times, because Kubrick just wasn't happy ever. Can you imagine working with somebody like that? No, do it again. 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 Just an absolute just tyrant. I mean, the guy made fantastic movies, but he just, you know, okay, we're going to do this 150 times. And it still wasn't good enough. He keep doing it again. And I remember they said Kubrick would drive actors to, like, drink or depression or... You know, he was kind of like, if Klaus Kinski was a director, he'd be Stanley Kubrick. Because as an actor, Klaus Kinski was like that. I remember, because Werner Herzog's like my favorite filmmaker. If I ever got Werner Herzog on this podcast, I would probably, like, just... I don't know. I would just fall on my knees and worship him. But anyway, so Werner Herzog's my favorite filmmaker of all time. And one of his best movies is Fitzcarraldo. And Klaus Kinski's in it. And there's that very, very famous incident where there's a scene in a film where Kinski's character is trying to stake a claim to some land in South America. He's got to go over a river. And to save time, instead of traversing the entire length of the river, he wants to take the boat he's on, which is a steamship, haul it over a mountain, and dump it on the river on the other side, thereby saving himself like 2 weeks of travel. Because this river meanders down and then comes back up in the direction he needs to go. So he's like, instead of going all the way down here, why don't we haul this boat over the mountain, back down the hill, and dump it on the other side of the river, which saves us hundreds of miles and weeks of travel. It's the character. Maybe that's just, I'm generalizing. So, instead of using models, Werner Herzog decides, because he's filming on location with a real steamship. So instead of using a model to represent it and just doing some creative filmmaking and cinematography to make it look like they're doing it, Werner Herzog decides they're actually going to haul this steamship over the mountain and dump it in. Now, I want you to understand what I just said. The scene in the film is Fitzcarraldo, the character, and the native people he's working with that are guiding him. He has them haul the boat over the mountain to put on the other side of the river. Werner Herzog actually does it and films it. Werner Herzog was working with a lot of native people of the area who were in the film and said, you know what, we're really going to build this ramp and we're really going to haul this boat over the mountain and I'm going to film it. And it's just beyond anything. It's something Herzog would do. I can't see any other filmmaker ever doing it. I mean, you know, Spielberg would have just had it CGI'd. Michael Bay would have just blown it up. Only Werner Herzog would do this. Maybe Terrence Malick, maybe. So, Kinski is being such a bastard during the filming of this movie. Abusing everybody, just being an absolute, just grade A a-hole. That the head of the tribe that is, you know, in this film, goes to Kinski one day and says, "If you want us to, we will." It goes to Herzog, excuse me. Goes to Herzog one day and says, "If you want us to, we will kill Kinski. We will kill him, and he'll just disappear." And you'll never be blamed for it. And we'll just say he fell in the river. But we'll kill him. And you have to understand, Herzog and Kinski were like best enemies. They had been in each other's lives for a long time. They both loved and hated each other. I think Herzog said every gray hair on his head was named Kinski. And as much as their history together of them, Kinski actually hesitated and thought for a second, maybe I should. And in the end, he's like, no. And if I remember the interview correctly, Herzog says, "And the reason I told them not to kill him was because I wanted to finish the movie." So apparently it had nothing to do with caring about Kinski. It was, I want to finish my movie. And I need him. Oh. And there was this rumor that Herzog directed Kinski at the point of a gun. Because Kinski was acting up and wouldn't do a scene. And Herzog went in his director's hut. Came out with a gun and told him that if Kinski didn't do the scene, he was going to kill Kinski and then blow his own head off. And held a gun on Kinski while he did the scene. That's a rumor. Herzog always said no. There's people said it actually happened. Whatever. But Kubrick was kind of like that driven. You see, driven people are usually very intelligent. But they're so intelligent and they're so creative that ordinary people look at them like they're psychotic or there's something mentally wrong with them. But there's usually not. It's just they're so creative, they're so driven, they don't belong here. They don't belong among ordinary people. Was Kinski an abusive monster? Herzog would know. I never met him. I just go by the movies I've seen, the interviews. There's a beautiful video on YouTube of Kinski with a butterfly that's walking on him, and Kinski has it in his hands and he's laughing, and a butterfly lands in his hair, and it's one of the most beautiful things you ever see. And then if you think about all the things you've heard about how Kinski was, it's like, how can the person gently holding this butterfly and interacting it with it be the person I heard that did this, this, and this? But a lot of creative people are misunderstood, and they're called outcasts, they're called psychotic, they're called mad, crazy, possessed. But it's just, they're so creative and they're so driven, they don't fit in this world. They don't belong here. They were an accident of placement by the universe. The universe was supposed to put them in a different place, not this planet, somewhere else, some different dimension, some different plane of existence where people like that are the norm, and somehow they slipped through the cracks and ended up here. That's how you end up with a Mozart, and how you end up with a Da Vinci, or a Galileo, or a Muhammad Ali, or a Kinski. That's how you end up with people like that. Extraordinary, brilliant people who just burn so much brighter than anybody else that they belong somewhere else and not here. But somehow they ended up here. But really, if you've never seen a Herzog film, you need to check out, like, Fitzcarraldo is my favorite. That's the one I like talking about the most. And Herzog, I mean, Rescue Dawn, Agua Verde, Aguirre, The Wrath of God. He does this beautiful mockumentary called Incident at Loch Ness. And an Incident at Loch Ness, the premise is it's Herzog and his crew playing themselves. And it's a movie within a movie. And basically, the movie is Herzog and his crew are going to film a documentary about the phenomenon of the Loch Ness Monster. Mostly focusing on the people who have claimed to have seen the monster and everything else. So they go on location to Loch Ness and rent a boat. And, they're out on the boat filming this documentary. And the boat is attacked by what apparently is the Loch Ness Monster. And the movie turns from a documentary into a kind of horror, suspenseful, survival film at this point. And, it's brilliant to see because it's such a good idea. And it's something only Werner Herzog would really be able to pull off. And it's such a good movie. And the idea behind it and everything, and the fact that everybody in the film is basically playing themselves. I mean, they're all real people. His crew, one of them's an Oscar-winning, I think, set designer or cinematographer. So there's a lot of talent in this film. Jeff Goldblum's in it for a couple minutes. Crispin Glover does a 10-second cameo where he shows up at a dinner party that Jeff Goldblum's having. And it's just like, hello, and that's the only time you see him. And there's no explanation of what he's doing there, or nobody even acknowledges him. Like, did Crispin Glover just, like, walk into the shot and he was just like, hey, what's going on? And they just left him in there? If you're going to start with the Herzog catalog, Incident at Loch Ness is kind of like the most mainstream one that anybody would be able to enjoy, because some of his stuff you really need to just absorb and think about and look at. And it's better to start off with something that basically, anybody of any age could go see it. And, Incident at Loch Ness, there's no nudity, there's no sex, there's no it's a mockumentary comedy horror film. And it's funny because I knew nothing about the film when I started watching it. I just knew it was Incident at Loch Ness with Werner Herzog. And I'm like, oh, it's Herzog. I'll watch it. I'm like, oh, he's doing a documentary about the Loch Ness Monster. This is unusual for him. He wouldn't usually get involved in a subject like this. But okay, I'll watch this. And then you slowly, as the boat gets attacked and people start getting eaten, you're like, this is turning into a horror movie. And then Herzog, pulls out a weapon. I'm like, is he becoming a superhero? Like, is he going to put on a cape and start flying? And it's just like, and it just slowly turns into this horror film that's kind of unsettling. Because, like Jaws, you don't really see the creature in Jaws you see him towards the end. In Incident at Loch Ness, you don't really see him until the very end. But you get glimpses of him. You know he's there because the water's being pushed around, and the waves, and the crashing. And it's not till the very end that they reveal him. But it's just, it's a slow burn, and it's, I mean, I know I just gave away the end of the film, but whatever. I mean, you would have figured it out anyway. But it's really, you gotta watch it, because it's really, it's a good place to start with the Werner Herzog canon of films. And you should go out and just get Incident at Loch Ness, because, I mean, I think it's a fantastic movie. And it's something, you know, it may be on Netflix. I mean, I don't know. It might be. Is it on Netflix? I don't have Netflix, so what do I know? It might. I mean, I'm sure you can find it online. I'm sure just whatever streaming channel service device you use, just type in Incident Loch Ness, and then watch Fitzcarraldo, because that's the other one I think that's more mainstream, and then Rescue Dawn is kind of mainstream after that, because then a lot of this stuff gets very existential and everything. If I remember correctly, he did a short film called Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, because he made a bet with somebody that if he lost, he was going to eat his shoe, and he lost the bet, and he actually ate the shoe, and he filmed it. I've never seen that one, but if I ever get him on the podcast, I'm going to ask him about that. But actually, I don't know. You know, if I ever got Herzog on the podcast, I'm the type of person that would totally not talk about his films. I would just, like, ask him other questions about things that have nothing to do with his career or his film. I would just be like, so, Werner, pineapple on pizza, what's your opinion? And just see what he has to say. That's the type of interviewer I am. Like, I had this thing, I was sitting around going, oh, man, what kind of guest could I have on here? And I said, man, it would be something if I had somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis on my podcast. Like, guy's won more Oscars than I have toes. You know, retired, famously private, guards his privacy like crazy. Nobody really knows anything about him. Like, if I got him on my podcast, people would just flip, because they'd be like, oh my God, you've got Daniel Day-Lewis on your podcast. You're going to ask him about his acting technique, his craft, his films, everything else. I'm like, no, actually, I'm the type of person that would just be like, so, I would ask him things that had nothing to do with anything he's ever done before. Tell you honest God truth, I remember there was a movie he was in, I can't remember what it was, but in order to prepare for the role, he went to Italy and actually apprenticed as a shoe cobbler for like a year for this movie part. And honestly, I'd probably ask him about that, because I'm fascinated by stuff like that. And I would ask him, you know, how do you build shoes? Like, how do you do that? How do they train you? I would ask him stuff like that, you know. I'd be like, so, pineapple and pizza, what do you think there, Daniel? That's the type of stuff I would ask. I would ask nothing to do with his career, and just random off-the-wall stuff, like, you know. Daniel Day-Lewis, VHS or Beta? Which one should have won that war? You know, type of thing. And, it's like if I had an adult actress on, like somebody like Riley Reid or Aurora Snow, I totally would not talk about the adult industry at all. I wouldn't even touch on it. I would just find something else completely, had nothing to do with it, and just go. You know, that might be my shtick, you know. Get people on and just talk about, you know, whatever. I remember years ago I read, I forget how young I was, this kid who wrote for a high school newspaper, and this is back when I was, I think, a teenager, this happened. Kid who wrote for a high school newspaper somewhere wanted to interview former President Nixon for the newspaper, and just, you know, sent him a letter and said, hey, I write for this school newspaper, I'd like to do an interview. Just not thinking anything of it. And then he gets contacted, I guess, by Nixon's representatives, who said President Nixon, because even though he's former president, they always refer to themselves as president. He's like, President Nixon would be glad to give you an interview. What's a good time? And Nixon calls him up, and he didn't talk about, and the kid who did the interview didn't touch on politics at all. Didn't ask him about his presidency, didn't ask him about the resignation, nothing. They talked about football. And I'm thinking, I remember back then, I'm like, oh man, what a missed opportunity. But, you know, as I got older, I'm like, that must have been so refreshing for Nixon, because he's probably like, okay, this kid's going to ask me this, this, and this about the presidency. I've heard this 100 times, so here we go again. And then the kid's like, all right, you know, How are the Browns going to do this year, Mr. President? I know you're a fan. And Nixon must have been like, thank God. And apparently the whole interview was just them talking football. You know, see, that's what I would do. But, you know, first I got to get, like, people on here. You know, this is what I'm going to do. During the break between episode 30 and season 5, when I do the big move, I'm going to somehow find... I'm going to send out emails to Werner Herzog and Daniel Day-Lewis and some other real top-tier A-list people and just say, hey, this is my podcast. I'm trying to build up my viewership, and I'd like to, you know, 5-10 minutes. And we're just going to talk about something that has nothing to do with what you're famous for. And just see who bites. Now, I'm thinking Herzog would bite because, I mean, come on, he voiced something in Rick and Morty. I mean, I think he's pretty... And, you know, I've heard Bill Murray pretty much will do almost anything you put in front of him as long as it's not a scam, so... And, but I would love to get somebody that nobody would ever think he'd get on here. Like, Daniel Day-Lewis would probably be, like, it, you know? Just, like, as far as the actors go, just getting him on here for, like, 10 minutes and just not talk about his acting career would just be the greatest thing. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to take the next couple weeks and start putting out emails and stuff and just... I just want to see who bites. You know, I just want to see if I can get somebody. Because if I get one famous or semi-famous person, that might kickstart my viewership or listenership. But we'll see. So, this concludes another episode of Victims of Fun. Next episode is episode 30. It is the season finale of season 4. Because then I got to do the big move back to the United States. So make sure you tune in. It's going to be a very special episode. I'm going to have some things on there I normally don't. I will be talking to the person who will be taking my spot at Mr. Fujiwara's. I hope he speaks English. But anyway. As always, you can email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by just doing a search for Victims of Fun. Listen to me on Spotify. Or on now on Pandora and Anchor FM, obviously. Just search for Victims of Fun and you'll see us. And make sure you hit that support button. Throw me some cash because I need it. I want to get my villa, you know. And tell you what, if I somehow manage to end up getting a villa because you people throw me money, I will invite a listener every... like 6 months to come visit me in my villa. And I'll make you cheesesteaks. So there you go. So, y'all have a great day and whatever you're doing. A great week or great whatever. And just remember, this is one world and we are one people. So, love each other. Thank you.